President Truman meets with Secretary of Agriculture Anderson and Director General of UNRWA, Fiorello LaGuardia. With the world food shortage reaching crisis proportions, the President speaks to America.
According to some of the statistics, and we're talking about 80% increases in the price of staple foods in some countries.
America cannot remain healthy and happy in the same world where millions of human beings are starving. A sound world order can never be built upon the foundation of human misery.
And tonight there's an urgent warning from the United Nations World Food Programme that a crisis point is near. Simply put, there simply isn't enough money to buy food for the millions who need it most, and if more money isn't found, then food aid in some places may have to be rationed or even halted.
Once again, I appeal to all Americans to sacrifice so that others may live. Millions will surely die unless we eat less. Again, I strongly urge all Americans to save bread and to conserve oils and fats. These are the most essential weapons at our disposal to fight famine abroad. Every slice of bread, every ounce of fat and oil saved by your voluntary sacrifice will help keep starving people alive.
At America's East Coast ports, emergency cargoes of flour and wheat are loaded. The United States is determined to do its share in helping the needy of the world.
Oh, man, can you picture any modern president asking Americans to give up a slice of bread to feed people overseas the way Harry Truman did in 1946? Are you kidding? We throw away more than most countries eat, but not for long. As millions of North Americans lose their jobs, the price of food just keeps going up. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith, and I'm telling you, it's time to take food seriously again. There are dark clouds on the horizon, maybe bread lines, and a depression worse than the last.
Those of you who have followed my career know that I'm a free market person. Until you're told that if you don't take decisive measures, then it's conceivable that our country could go into depression greater than the Great Depression.
In this program, you will hear a report from the ETC group that outlines how a few giant multinationals have taken over your food supply. But their dreams of dominating nature and turning every living thing into a product for profit is turning into a nightmare. In the second half hour, you will learn why it might be time to stock up food now for yourself and your loved ones and how to do it. We've also got a feature recorded last night. Max Donnellan explains how we can make hybrid humans that generate their own power. That's right, just walking around, you create your own electricity. Coming up in the second half hour of Radio EcoShock. Let's start with the big picture with our guest, Kathy Jo Wetter. Who owns nature, corporate power, and the final frontier in the commodification of life? That's the title of the 100th newsletter or publication coming from the ETC Group. It's published in November 2008. It's an ambitious report naming exactly which corporations are trying to take over the world's food and drug industry, from seeds through processing and chemicals all the way to your grocery store and your body. One of the researchers and authors of the report, Kathy Jo Wetter, is here to tell Radio EcoShock listeners why we should worry about our food supply and who manufactures it. Welcome, Kathy.
Thanks.
Well, your new report reads like a summary of who runs the world in a way when it comes to all the stuff coming into our bodies. Why did the ETC group take this on?
Well, really for the last 30 years, my organization has tracked what we call the life industry. And those are industries that are particularly related to food, pharmaceuticals, seeds, both humans, animals, and we have tried to track corporate concentration, and that means how fewer and fewer companies have a larger market share in those sectors. And we think that tracking corporate concentration is really an important thing to do, because what we've seen is that when there is a high degree of corporate concentration that it entrenches corporate power, which undermines the ability of small-scale producers and particularly to produce foods and medicines for their own communities.
Well, listeners, I want to just describe this report a little bit, and later on we're going to tell you where you can get it. Who Owns Nature is 52 pages. There's lots of links and notes to follow up, and there are some good graphs and illustrations to make this data clear in our minds. You don't have to be an expert to read it by any means. It's broken down into four sections, and I'll read these quickly for you, and then we'll talk over a couple of them. So the main sections are the corporate farm inputs, the seeds, agrochemicals, fertilizers, the seed industry, which you've heard so much about. And then section two is corporate food outputs, the food and beverage manufacturing, the grocery retailers, all the people who are bringing these food products and beverages to you. Section three is about corporate medicine and health, the big pharma, biotech, animal pharmaceuticals, something called bioinformatics, which I hope we'll hear more about. And section four is commodifying nature's last straw, extreme genetic engineering, and the post-petroleum sugar economy. That sounds very interesting. We'll get to that near the end of this interview. And then there's the conclusion titled, The Global Economy, Who's Got the Power? And that's the question we all want to know. So, Kathy, let's start at the beginning of that food chain, the seeds. Here's one quote that really struck my eye. It says, from thousands of seed companies and public breeding institutions, three decades ago, 10 companies now control more than two-thirds of global proprietary seed sales. So what are the risks when it comes to these multinational corporate ownership of seeds?
Well, the first risk is that the seed is the first link in the food chain. And so whoever controls the seed really does control the food. And it so happens that the largest seed company, Monsanto, was not a seed company to begin with. It was a chemical company. And so the fact that we have these chemical companies buying up seed companies, and yes, it's true that there used to be thousands of seed companies, and now we really do have this sector is concentrated so much so that Monsanto is responsible. It has a 23% market share. Just one company is in control of almost a quarter of seeds and of seed sales. And so when you've got one company with that much control over the first link in the food chain, that's concerning.
Well, you know, I'm thinking about the seed bank up in Spitsbergen, is it? It's somewhere way up.
Svalbard.
There you go. And, you know, perhaps one of the reasons we really need that seed bank is not because there will be a great crash that threatens agriculture, but because these big companies are dropping so many of the heritage seeds that were designed to live in certain circumstances and to fight off certain problems. Do you think that's a concern?
I think it is. I think that, you know, if you are producing seeds on an industrial scale, you aren't producing seeds that are adapted to very small locales. And that's one of the wonderful things about saving seeds, when farmers can pick seeds from one harvest to plant the next year. They are picking those seeds that work best in their own environment. And that's really important, particularly with climate change, that you do need this kind of small-scale selection of seeds that can adapt to these changing environmental conditions. And so it's true that Monsanto is now the largest seed company in the world, and it's buying up all these small seed companies, and it's dropping the seeds that are no longer, that do not have intellectual property attached to them. So what Monsanto wants to sell is seeds that are patented and therefore cannot be saved legally. They can't be reused. They have to be bought every year.
It's almost like creating a seed junkie, you know. You have to come back to the big company because the age-old system of saving your own seeds is out the window. Well, another thing that struck me out of the report, it talks about One quarter of the world's annual biomass, so that includes all the crops and the livestock and the fisheries that we have integrated into the world economy, is controlled by just a handful of companies. So I'm getting this sort of dark picture that nature almost is becoming a subsidiary of a few big multinational corporations. Am I just being paranoid here?
It does seem to be the case. We have a great quote in our report from the Executive Secretary of the United Nations Convention on Biological Diversity, and this was at a meeting in Germany this past May. And the Executive Secretary's name is Ahmed Joglaf, and he said, "The largest corporation is not Walmart or General Motors. The largest corporation is nature." And he was talking to a group from civil society organizations and social movements at the time. And this was quite shocking to the audience because, of course, we don't want to think of nature as a corporation. We don't want to think of nature as being simply a commodity. But this does seem to be the trend, that there is this idea that controlling nature is profitable. And it's something that has been true for a long time, but the degree to which it's true now is becoming more and more disturbing.
And your report, which is the 100th issue of the ETC communique, and you update an earlier report called Oligopoly, Inc., and you've said that over the past three decades of agribusiness, efforts to monopolize the 24% of living nature that has already been commodified. Now, I have to stop right there. 24% of living nature is already commodities. They're products, according to these people. And now there's a new strategy to try and get the rest of it, the last three quarters, that's been outside the market economy. How could that be?
One of the things that we're really concerned about, that may make nature even more a commodity, is something that is called synthetic biology. And that's a relatively new technology that involves actually creating living organisms that are designed to perform a particular task. And we call it also extreme genetic engineering. And with extreme genetic engineering, or at least the way that it's being developed right now, for these organisms to create, and they can create plastics, they can create fuels, they can create pharmaceuticals, but what they need is biomass. They need, it's a kind of fermentation that requires a feedstock, and that feedstock has to have sugar, it has to have cellulose, it has to have carbohydrate. And that can come from plant matter, but what that means is that you need huge quantities of plant matter to feed these organisms to get them to produce these high-value chemicals or pharmaceuticals or fuels. And so the trend is to think about how can we get unlimited quantities of biomass, and the way that you do that is you try to get feedstocks that work. And feedstocks that can come from anywhere can come from what they're saying as grasses or leftover corn stover, these things that normally that someone can consider agricultural waste, that can then be the feedstock for these organisms to produce these other high-value chemicals or fuels or pharmaceuticals. So that trend of really thinking about nature as and all of nature as a possible kind of input to a product is something that we are watching very, very closely.
We are talking with Kathy Jo Wetter, researcher and co-author of the new report, Who Owns Nature? Corporate Power and the Final Frontier in the Commodification of Life, from the ETC Group. Well, another thing I found in the report quite interesting to me was the idea that these companies are talking about stopping climate change with their biotechnology and their new ways, when in fact they may have accelerated climate change in the first place by using so many petrol fuels and oil-based products in their type of industrial agriculture. How can they claim to stop climate change for us?
Well, it's true. There, it's quite interesting that the biotech Technology Industry Organization, which is really the industry's kind of lobby group in the U.S., that it is it's saying that GE crops are the solution to the current food crisis and to climate change. And they're saying that for climate change, that they can genetically engineer crops to withstand environmental stresses such as drought, heat, cold, floods. But of course, these crops are going to be proprietary. They're going to come from proprietary seed. And they're actually, what companies are doing right now is trying to get patents on gene sequences that they say will be useful to engineer into crops to make them crops able to withstand climate change. So they are telling us, I mean, what they told us before is that genetically engineered crops were the solution to hunger, and that obviously was not the case. So now they're saying that genetically engineered crops are the solution to climate change.
Well, you raise this issue of hunger. The number of food insecure people, it says in your report, went from 849 million to 982 million just in the last couple of years. And, you know, where the UN said they were going to cut hunger around the world, in fact, it is projected to increase by 50% by 2015. So they didn't keep their original promise that industrial agriculture would feed the world. Now it's feeding the world who can afford to pay, and the rest seem to get left off. So there is a social and political dimension to these developments we're discussing. Can you touch on that a little bit?
Sure. A World Bank report actually says that the biggest contributor to the increase in food prices around the world is this new trend for biofuels, what we call agrofuels. And your listeners may have heard of the food versus fuel debate, that because many crops, like corn, for example, that could be used as food are actually going to fuel, that is something that's making food prices go up. And we have a great cartoon that's by Tom Tolles. It was in the Washington Post originally, but it's we got permission to use it in our report, of a smiling Uncle Sam with a drum of ethanol beside him. And there is an elderly woman in a grocery store with a grocery cart, and her grocery cart is empty because of the high food prices. And she's asking Uncle Sam, can you make it back into corn? So this food versus fuel debate is a big issue. And it's true that the biotechnology industry, it's very interesting. Their current slogan is heal, fuel, feed the world. So they're saying that not only, you know, they, as you point out, they didn't feed the world, but now they're also going to heal the world, and they're also going to fuel the world. And it's interesting that even between the food corporations, the really big food corporations like Unilever and Coca-Cola and Nestle and PepsiCo, that they're actually fighting it out with the biotech industry and the big agribusiness giants like Monsanto, DuPont, Archer Daniels Midland, and they're kind of fighting about it because the grocery manufacturers are saying, look, biofuels are causing really high food prices, and this is hurting us. But now these huge food corporations are saying, you know, we care about the environment and we care about hungry people, so we don't want biofuels. And then on the other end, the Monsantos and DuPonts and Archer Daniels Midland companies are saying, we can both feed and fuel the world. And they have formed an alliance called the Alliance for Abundant Food and Energy. And we think that sounds like a bedtime story in utopia, that that in the face of both hunger and this increased demand of fuel, that they are going to somehow figure out a way to use technology and, of course, proprietary technologies, including genetically modified crops, to find an answer. We are very doubtful about their intentions and doubtful about their prospects for success.
Well, you've raised GE Foods, and this report has some shocking figures in there, and one of them that struck me was that About half of the world's genetically engineered crops are grown in the U.S., and they may even have three different traits, triple stacked, all genetically engineered. So it feels like here in North America, where GE foods aren't even labeled, that we're part of one big experiment. We may find out 10, 20, 30 years from now whether there's cancer or birth defects or mental disorders or other problems coming out of this. Nobody knows, because humans have never eaten GE food before. The Europeans haven't accepted this so much. Why are the American public just sleepwalking into this possible problem, do you think?
I think there certainly are groups, individuals who are actively seeking out non-genetically modified foods, and it's also true that that if you look at the kind of growth potential in grocery and food, that the biggest growth potential is in organic and natural foods, and that's why the big companies are really trying to buy a stake in that organic food movement. So I think that people do recognize that, are beginning to recognize that we don't know the consequences of these genetically modified foods that we're eating, but because, you know, food prices are becoming such an issue, that we'll have to see how that tension plays out. And it also is true, I believe, that when the U.S. government asked for comments on genetically modified foods in terms of could they be allowed in organic, could genetically modified foods be considered organic, they got more comments about that than any other issue that they had ever asked for the public for comments about. So I think there is an awareness, but I also think that the corporations do have so much power. And, you know, what happened in the U.S. is that the corporations got a great deal. The government worked with them to make it so that there was this idea that a genetically modified food was substantially equivalent to one that was not genetically modified. And that gave the companies a wonderful leg up, because they didn't have to actually prove that their products were safe. They just said they're the same. And unfortunately, that meant that some of these, you know, the rigorous testing and the kind of long-term evaluation just didn't happen.
Another thing that got me in this report was when we think about the financial crisis that's unwinding and about peak oil coming up on us, I'd just like to read this one paragraph here about the surprising role of urban agriculture. It kind of gives me hope in a way. It says, "It is conservatively estimated that 15 to 20% of the world's food is produced in urban areas, and 800 million urban residents are involved in some form of agriculture. 64% of the residents of Nairobi grow at least some of their own food. In Kathmandu, 37% of food producers grow all the vegetables consumed in their households, and 11% of animal products. Same in Hanoi, quite high figures there. You've got freshwater fish, poultry, pork, all raised in urban areas. In Accra, 90% of the city's fresh vegetables are produced within the city." So I could see that happening here in North America. That is a little bit of a hopeful sign, perhaps.
That's right. Even in my town, locally, there's legislation that's going to the town council about allowing hens within the city limits. So I think there is an understanding that local food is it can be cheaper, it can be healthier, and it certainly is fresher. And I'm really glad that you brought that paragraph up, Alex, because although we do, as you said at the beginning of the program, sort of paint a bleak picture of the power of corporations and their control over our food and our bodies, we do try in the report to bring out some of the resistance movements that I think are really, really important. And one of the things we point out is that even though Walmart is the largest buyer and seller of food, not to mention that it's the world's largest corporation, even though it is the largest buyer and seller of food, it accounts for only 3.5% of the $5.1 trillion spent on retail food worldwide in 2007. And it's been estimated that 85% of the world's food is still produced relatively close to where it is consumed. And I think that's really important to keep in mind, that it's true that Walmart has pervaded our lives, but it's also true that there are millions of people around the world that are working towards something that is called food sovereignty, this idea that food should be locally controlled and it should be socially just. And so there is this resistance to these this corporate control.
Wow. Well, we haven't even had a chance to get to the Beyond Petroleum movement, where corporate power could try and use biofuels. We talked about it very briefly, and there's all the whole debate about pesticides and the effects on bees, whether the bees can survive this. There's just so much in this report. Even the feudalization of wealth, where about 1,100 billionaires control most of the world's wealth, while more than a billion people have nothing at all. So, and just the fact that people can stop shopping for cars or electronics, but they're going to keep buying food. So these people, these corporations, I should say, are right at the bottom of the food chain, literally. We've been speaking with Kathy Jo Wetter, one of the researchers and authors of the report, Who Owns Nature? Corporate Power and the Final Frontier in the Commodification of Life. It's published by the ETC Group in November 2008. Kathy, where can people get this report and find out more?
Well, you can go to our website to get the report. It's www.etcgroup.org, ETC Group, all one word. And all of our publications, including our past publications that tracked the life industry, are available free on our website. And this, I think, Who Owns Nature is kind of a nice overview to see how corporations play a role in all these sectors that are so important in our lives.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Kathy Jo Wetter, thank you so much for telling us about all this.
Thanks for inviting me.
If this is the new depression, it sure doesn't look like it in the shopping malls, does it? There's an ongoing discussion in the Big Picture blog hosted by Barry Ritholtz. Most of the contributors are in the financial industry. In an open weekend thread in mid-November 2008, there were reports of full shopping malls from all over the United States. How can that be, with retail statistics officially dropping like a stone? Don't these people know they need to save their money for hard times? One blog writer caught my eye and my heart. He wrote, "Read the full malls. This has me confused and worried, most because of the ex's behavior. I've been out of a job for nearly a year. That's with a JD and a government clearance. We're plowing through the retirement. And she can't, not won't, can't seem to moderate her lifestyle beyond not buying dessert at Panera. When things are worst, she has this irresistible urge to go shopping. Thank God it's at food stores, not department stores, but hey. I am scared that this will not unwind. Rather, it will snap. One day, one discreet sun-up to sundown day, tens of millions of people will go from thinking life is fair, good, and worth living, to a life that is solitary, nasty, brutish, and short. Before that day, we will blog, shop, commute, and after that day, we will hide, starve, and fight." Whew, well, that's a pretty bleak view. It's not my view, but that is the snap factor that many of us worry about, the snap factor. I'm learning how to store food. You never know. Even if I'm only 10% right about my worries, I might be really glad I tried it. Up until the early 1970s, you know, the United States and other countries were storing excess food in huge amounts. For example, they had multi-years' worth of dairy products and at least 2 years' worth of wheat in storage. Sometimes they kept this stuff in caves. There was partly the Cold War mentality, but more to keep prices up for the farm in the face of new production coming on. Radio EcoShock will be right back in 30 seconds with more food worries and what you can do, plus our hot new feature on hybrid human power. Hi, I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. If you've just tuned in, we're talking about possible food shortages in your future, whether you have a job left or not. We'll look into long-term food storage with an interview, and then flip tracks to a new climate-changing idea. It's called hybrid humans that produce their own power. As we pick up, I'm mulling over the lack of food warehousing. We have little protection against a bad harvest or a transportation failure anymore compared to the 1970s. The American government decided it was cheaper to pay farmers not to plant certain crops rather than trying to store it or give it away. Even Ronald Reagan was accused of running one of these dummy farms where a check comes in even though no planting was really ever intended. Thus, the idea of storing food nationally just fell away. In parallel, the huge food warehouses in every city have fallen into disrepair and disuse. Instead, corporations found it better to use the rolling trucks themselves on the road as their warehouses. It's called just-in-time delivery. Your peppers go straight from the shipper to your local grocery store. There are no central warehouses storing food should the highway and the trucking system break down, or if a terrible disease breaks out in California, or the truckers all go bankrupt and stop coming. Add in climate change, of course. The Midwest floods this year removed up to 1 billion bushels of corn. That includes crops flooded out, but also the dry storage that was damaged. From next year's food supply, it's gone. At the very same time, on both sides of the hurricane and tornado alley, drought continued to damage crops in the U.S. Southeast and the Southwest. It isn't a good time for farming and thus for food production. Then there is the UG-99 wheat rust problem. This fungus doesn't stunt the plant, reducing the harvest. It kills it. Wherever UG-99 appears, it must be eradicated immediately, although poor farmers may not be able to do so. UG-99, also known as black stem rust, was discovered in Uganda in 1999. It spread to neighboring countries in East Africa. Then, around 2004, the only known Category 5 hurricane in the Indian Ocean hit that area on the east coast of Africa. The storm winds spread the fungus into the Middle East, and it has now reached Iran, a major wheat-producing country. This black stem rust threatens to head towards the breadbasket of the Punjab in India, and the Ukraine, another big wheat producer, is also on the alert for it. Eventually, with globalization and shipping, this UG-99 fungus is likely to get to the United States and Canada. Or the spores could be carried by the winds and the migratory birds, who knows where. Scientists have discovered strains of wheat resistant to UG-99, but it could take at least 5 years to produce enough seed, distribute it, and get farmers planting the alternative. This UG-99 thing is something to watch. It could come up, and it could be a reason why you want to store away some wheat so you have a couple of years' worth. The father of the Green Revolution, Nobel laureate Norman Borlaug, said, quote, "This thing has immense potential for social and human destruction." Read about it in an article called "Billions at Risk from Wheat Super Blight." That's April 3, 2007, by Deborah McKenzie. Wheat rusts have been with us since the times of the Romans, but every now and then a new variety pops up, and we can do little to stop it. The last hit was in 1954 when 40% of the North American wheat crop was wiped out. Think about that, 40% in 1 year. A global rust initiative has been started up, but with the financial crisis, will it get the money it needs? Our methods of growing dense wheat in more parts of the planet have also created ideal conditions for the developments of new fungi. In the wild, plants are mixed and spread out, aren't they? But heavy human agriculture breeds new plant diseases, just the way thousands of animals packed in together breeds new things like the H1N5 bird flu virus. The U.S., sure, it has fungicides, but only enough for one crop at a time. Most of it has been going to fight off the soybean rust, which blew over the country following Hurricane Ivan. If UG-99 arrives as well, there won't be enough fungicides. Note that both the Soviet Union and the United States stored up some crop fungi, like wheat rust, as possible biological weapons to starve out their enemies. Could this be a terrorist weapon as well, we wonder? The New Scientist magazine reports the U.S. Department of Homeland Security has just met to discuss this very wheat rust problem, agricultural terrorism. In 6 out of the last 7 years of this new century, we consumed more wheat than we grew. No wonder stocks are dwindling.
We're now down to 55 days of consumption. This is carryover stocks. How much grain you have in the bin when the new harvest begins. That's the lowest on record. We are one poor harvest away from chaos in world grain markets.
The owner of ReadyReserveFoods.com, David Sibley, says that if there was a sudden run on this small industry, they couldn't provide 0.25% of the potential demand. But it does show that people who wait for a panic situation may not be able to get long-term food storage equipment or even the food itself. Maybe you want to act a little sooner than the crowd. Incidentally, Sibley recommends people keep quiet about their food stocks. Well, you can think about why that might be. And every day, the world adds another 200,000 people to feed. We're going to an interview with a Canadian survival food supplier, Kerry from Survival Supply Canada. The experts predict a coming depression worse than the 1930s. Does that make you worry about the most basic things like food and shelter? Maybe a year's worth of stored food will be more valuable than gold. Our generation has lost many of the old skills of canning and root cellaring, but there are some new techniques out there for storage that our grandparents didn't have. I'm Alex Smith from Radio EcoShock. We have Kerry from Survival Supply Canada on the line to help us explore food insurance, no matter what happens to our jobs or the economy. Hello, Kerry.
Well, hello, and thank you for the opportunity.
It's great to have you here. And I know you operate SurvivalPro.com, a Canadian mail-order website for survival gear, and some of your past customers must be extreme campers and such. But I'm wondering, are you finding economic fears bring you a new kind of more mainstream customer? Is business picking up?
Well, it's a little bit like year 2000, where you have people basically preparing for any eventuality, and some people are buying foods for a month, even 6 months. So, yes, there is a definite change.
A lot of Canadians who are used to having a lot of country around them think they'll just head out into the country if a new depression comes, but that's really a tough track, a tough way to go. So a lot of us are going to be stuck wherever we are, kind of homesteading in our suburban homes or even our downtown condos. Can we still store food?
Yes, you can. There's several different ways you can do that. Either going to your local store, or you can go a step further. You can do some of the canning and preserving yourself, or you can buy ready-made preservatives.
Well, what if we don't have a cool basement to store it? Does that rule out food storage?
No, it doesn't. There are foods that you can store in a regular room temperature, which were developed for the Apollo project in the 1960s. And basically, the shelf life for foods like that can be anywhere from 5 to 10 years.
And I suppose dried foods would be fine for that, too?
To a certain extent. It really depends on the moisture content on the food.
Well, supposing I know nothing about food storage, I'm just starting. If you had to pick 5 basic items to put away to get going, what would they be?
Well, it really depends on the foods that you eat, and that's the biggest mistake people do. Most people think, okay, I'm going to have to store food, and they go and buy these pre-made packages, but you really should be looking for foods that you use every day. Psychologically, it's a lot more comforting to have something that you're used to eating rather than something that you never had before. Water, of course, is one of the main ingredients, because if you don't have water, you can't do anything. Something like pastas, dry soups, freeze-dried vegetables, freeze-dried meats are a really good start.
Yeah, well, I'm starting one little project I've got going is to put some wheat, some rice, some pinto beans, and peas into 5-gallon buckets, and I've ordered some oxygen depleters and Mylar bags from you. How do those work, and how long could I expect my food to keep if I manage to store it properly?
Well, the food should be good for a minimum of 5 years. And basically, with what you're looking at preserving, you have no problems. The only problem in rice, for example, could be that if you have brown rice, it has a lot more oils on the surface than the white rice, so you have to be careful what you store. But it really is fairly simple. You just use the bags with the oxygen absorber inside, seal it, push most of the air out before you seal it, put it in the container, and away you go.
Why do I have to get the oxygen out of there?
Well, the oxygen is what makes everything grow. So if you have a bacterial growth, it needs oxygen. So oxygen is the number one enemy that you have in food preservation other than botulism, which actually doesn't require oxygen.
Do you think it's safe, really, to store dried milk? And I notice you even have dried butter on your site. How can an oil product like that be dried?
Well, it's not real butter. The only butter that you can really buy that's real is can-formed, and it's made in Australia. It is a man-made butter, but it's, it tastes like the real thing. It's very difficult to freeze-dried items that have a high fat content.
All righty. And, you know, another question I had is I'm looking at getting some skim milk in bags, so I'll have some milk if I have water, but I'm sort of worried maybe it comes from China and it's got some melamine in it. Do we really know where our milk products are coming from?
You don't. And, I mean, Canadian Food Inspection Agency has websites and they have information on their sites for different manufacturers. But really, there's no way of knowing, and the only thing you can ask for is from the supplier what the origin of the food item is.
Right. Well, you know, you have a lot of items for people heading out into the wild. I don't see a major exodus of city folks into the country. Most people don't know how to survive without retail shops and the government. But I suppose any of us could be made suddenly homeless due to an earthquake or a big fire or a bad mortgage or losing your job. And so the number of homeless is expected to grow rapidly in the next couple of years, and nobody's completely immune. So I'm wondering, if you make money now, does it sense to stock up a backpack with camping gear just in case?
Well, I don't think it's a bad idea to have. I almost look at it as an insurance. I mean, we have life insurance, home insurance, car insurance. I don't think it's that bad to spend maybe a few hundred dollars and have some food in store, just in case you hit the hard times, and that will help you get back on your feet.
Well, even if the worst doesn't happen, I have enjoyed finding out more about food and our fragile food system. You know, home cooking with the basics is healthier and cheaper anyway. Do you think there's a positive side to our growing social fears?
I think it is. It's. I think you see, I see more people doing gardening, learning more about how to grow your own food, become more aware of it, where it comes from. I mean, it's said that average distance the food travels right now is about 5,000 miles, so that's a long way for food to travel.
And it makes climate change gases as it moves around. I'm Alex Smith, and this is Radio EcoShock. We've been talking with Kerry from Survival Supply Canada. His website is survivalpro.com. Kerry, thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you.
And now for something completely different.
How about hybrid humans that produce their own electric power just by walking around? Not only does this device exist, it makes walking easier, not harder. The invention is in its early stages, led by Max Donnellan of the Simon Fraser University Locomotion Lab. The prototypes are being taken commercial to provide power for those needing heart stimulation or other internal body pumps that require a sure and rechargeable source of electricity. But the future possibilities are astounding. You could power your iPod/phone/computer just by walking down to the corner store. Perhaps in the future, all of us will become independent power stations, removing the need for those climate-killing fossil fuel plants. I caught up with Max Donnellan at the Café for Scientists at the Vancouver Public Library on November 19, 2008. In this clip, introduced by CBC radio personality Hal Wake, Max explains his invention plus the basics of human power use.
Our first presenter is Max Donnellan. Max is the director of the SFU Locomotion Laboratory and an assistant professor in the School of Kinesiology. He's also the inventor of a biomechanical energy harvester and CEO of Bionic Power Inc., the company that's developing that technology, and I think he'll probably tell us a bit about that and some of his other activities. Please welcome Max Donnellan.
So my research is focused on how people move, mostly people, sometimes other animals too. I've studied elephants and crocodiles and kangaroos. And I used techniques from biomechanics, which is the application of engineering to the study of movement, and neurophysiology, and what's called energetics. So the intersection of how much energy people need to move and how people choose the way they move in order to minimize metabolic cost. And so that's, in general, what I do. I apply that as I mentioned, not only to sort of exotic animals, but to healthy people and also people who are recovering from things like stroke. And along the way, I happen to also be one of the inventors of a device that's called the Bionic Energy Harvester. And this device captures energy from your walking. It converts it to electricity, and we use it to power portable devices. For example, you could power about 30 cell phones at the same time, or you, with 1 minute of walking, you could power, you get about 30 minutes of talk time. And it does another neat trick, which is kind of the cool thing it does, which is it only selectively engages its power generation at times when the muscles are normally slowing the body down. And so it helps those muscles in slowing the body down. And that happens with every stride. So it's not just when you're coming to a stop, but within every walking stride, your muscles are slowing your body down. And this helps doing that. And then gets out of the way when those same muscles act to speed it up again. And this is just like regenerative braking in hybrid cars. And the benefit of this is that you can produce electricity without requiring an increase in your effort. And so it's a suitable technology for powering portable biomedical devices like prosthetic limbs or drug pumps or things of that nature. The early adopters will likely be people like that whose lives depend upon portable power, as opposed to maybe you or I who have used portable power as a convenience, because we can always go home and plug our cell phone in at night. If you disagree with that statement, you should speak up, because I'd love to hear from people who want to use this today. And, and I have been getting that feedback, at least from some sources. So one of the most fundamental principles about how we move, especially rhythmic, cyclical movements like walking that you do over and over again, is that you choose the way you do that in order to minimize your metabolic cost. In other words, your chemical energy. In other words, the food you use. And so think about walking. You could walk in any number of ways. Maybe you've seen the Ministry of Silly Walks, Monty Python, right? Those seem silly, but you could get from here to there by walking in those ways, but you choose not to. And you choose not to because it minimizes your effort to walk in the way that you walk. There's nothing I can do to you, perturb you in different ways to make walking easier for you, with a few exceptions, but those aren't important. So why do we do that? Well, the theory seems to be, my field believes that, well, you like a lot of animals, you evolved under circumstances where resources were limited. And so you would, meaning food. And so when you did have to move, you would choose to move in a way that minimized the food you would need to get for that day. That would give you more time to, you wouldn't have to spend as much time looking for food, which means you could spend more time hiding from predators, or more time reproducing, whichever one you wanted to do. And but nevertheless, it makes a lot of evolutionary sense that you wouldn't want to be spending all your time looking for food. So you want to move as economically as you possibly could. And when you did have food, you probably want to eat it all because it's limited resources. And so you have this instinct in that you want to, from over millions of years, that you want to eat the food that you have, and that you want to move as economically as possible. And so that's an uphill battle you're fighting against as a person if you're trying to lose weight, because all your instincts say, take the elevator and move as efficiently as you possibly can. So even if you're cycling, in the way that minimizes your metabolic cost for doing that cycling. You could cycle in a less coordinated way, but you don't. And also, given the choice, you would prefer to offload any work you can to something else, like your car. And so this internal drive, which has served us so well over evolution to minimize the metabolic energy we use, the chemical energy we use, works against us in terms of climate change, because we prefer to have other things do the work for us, like cars, and works against us in terms of obesity, because we prefer to conserve as much of our own chemical energy we can, which means we accumulate it. And so from my side of things, I can make walking harder. And it's just not really as cool as making it easier. And so it's much harder to make walking easier than it is to make it harder. And there are groups of people for which walking is very hard. And those are groups that need this sort of electricity. And so after stroke, one of the things is it's very, so if you ask, on average, stroke patients, what they would like to do most is to walk again. And for them, their ability to walk is constrained in a severe way by the amount of metabolic energy it requires to walk. And there are devices, electrical devices, that can help them walk faster and longer and so on, but they need
power. Expending less energy.
Yes. And so if you were to get the electricity to power their device, which helps them by making walking harder, then that's no good. So instead, you'd like to get that electricity in a way that doesn't make walking harder, so the device that you're powering can actually work towards making their walking. If you wanted to get electricity, if you wanted to get electricity and you're near the power lines, the human body is probably not a good place to go. So although I'm one of the inventors of a device that captures energy from the human body to produce electricity, the early adopters are really going to be people who don't have the power grid available to them, you know, who are away from that, because it costs something like 3 cents a kilowatt hour here in BC, whereas that would take 100 people walking for an hour to get from my device. Right? So
yours is practical in situations where the power grid is crashed, where people need power for walkie-talkies or for lights and all kinds of things, and it at that point makes sense to be using your own.
Right. Exactly. It doesn't, from a very direct point of view, it doesn't make any sense to get 10 watts, or let's say 50 watts to 100 watts maximum from a person if they're pedaling a stationary bike or turning a hand crank, of electricity to feed back into the grid, because that's nothing, right? Per capita, if you average it out over the world, we consume on average about 10 kilowatts each person. Okay, so watts is an instantaneous measure. So at just sitting here, you're burning through 10 kilowatts. And the most you can produce is on the order of about 100 watts. And so you're about 100 times short of what you would need to fulfill your own energy needs.
Sorry, we're burning 10 kilowatts over what?
I mean, if you take the whole planet's power consumption for everything that it's powering, for manufacturing, for producing your food, for actually delivering power to your house, That's a number. When you divide by the population, it ends up being, on average, about 10 kilowatts, so 10,000 watts, right? It's about that.
Yeah, over what period?
No. So if you think about, so watts are an instantaneous measure. This is like your light bulb is 100 watts, and so every hour it's using 100 watt hours, and so every second it's using 100 joules. That's the definition of watts. And then, so if you want to think about it in terms of watt hours, then we are using 10,000 watt hours per hour. And on average, and if you divide the total energy, the total power that the planet's using so in fact, probably most of us are responsible for much more than that, because so many people in this world have a much smaller footprint than we do, right? So it's an incredibly huge number, and much, much more than we can produce individually by pedaling a stationary bike. So another way to think about it is we need a planet with 100 times our population to pedaling stationary bikes to power our population, right? They would need a planet which would be bigger, and you know, obviously this explodes at some point. So producing electricity if you're near the grid with people power is not a good idea for directly to produce electricity. It may be a good idea to philosophically connect people to the meaning of electricity, because I don't think we have a good intuitive sense for that. So I don't think, you know, there's probably a few people in the room here, but probably most of us have no idea how many batteries it would take to power their house for an hour. They probably don't have any idea how many cheeseburgers it would take to power their house for an hour. Both of those things are energy. It would be something like you know, on the, my house is something like, let's say, 1,000 watt hours, or I go through, let's say, 24 watt kilowatt hours per day. So that means that for an hour, I would need about 1 kilowatt hour. And so if you produce that with batteries, it would be about 10 kilograms worth of batteries per hour you'd go through. 10 kilograms of batteries. That's a huge amount of batteries, 20, right?
Some 25 pounds of battery.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And so...
How many cheeseburgers, though?
A lot less.
Oh.
So the
I'm going the cheeseburger route.
fat has so there's a quantity we call specific energy, which is the amount of energy per unit mass that something has, and fat is about 100 times greater than the best batteries, and about equivalent to gasoline. So you can in that way, and so you know if we store the average person stores about 10 kilograms of fat in their body. Something like that, roughly, which makes us equivalent to about a 1,000 kilogram battery. Anyway, so I'm sort of getting off topic a little bit.
Yeah,
here,
we have to get back to the.
So just to bring it back, which is that the only reason you would want to produce electricity in a gym to feed back into the main lines would be one, a philosophical one of reconnecting people with what exactly how hard it is to produce that electricity so they have an understanding of what it means to turn on a 100-watt light bulb, because we don't have a very good intuitive sense for that. But it doesn't make any sense in terms of actually having an impact on how much energy we're using from gas or coal or what have you.
At this point, your host, Alex Smith of Radio EcoShock, just had to ask one of those loony green questions about how to save the Earth from ourselves.
I find your idea of a hybrid human producing power to be really exciting for the future, and I dispute your idea that it's not worthwhile to do it near a power line. First of all, maybe outside of BC, many of the power lines are coal producing or coming from coal, so they're changing our climate. And perhaps, you know, you were talking about the number of watts or so on that we use currently, but we're horribly inefficient. I mean, we could all be sitting here, for example, with LED headlamps on, just only projecting light where we're looking, and maybe they'll even turn off when we blink because we don't need light then. You know, there's various ways that we could make a super efficient energy system that might run off our own bodies while improving our body efficiency. What a brilliant idea for 50 years from now if we just get going on it at this point, even with people in the gym.
Well, I think the biggest effect you can have in that way is by reducing our energy needs then, right? So, you know, if we're sitting here, we're producing about 100 watts of heat, right? So that's at the maximum that you're going to get from someone just sitting around, 100 watts. But yet we're, even just sitting here, we're using a lot more than 100 watts for each one of us in this room. And so the best thing we can do is reduce it so that if we could exist off of our own power, that it would be low enough that we could that it's capable to get from the person. And that would be of huge benefit to the planet, you know, so that we stay within the means of what we can actually produce ourselves. But regard to the fact that some of our electricity is produced with coal and so on, that could be very powerful, except of what Wolfgang had brought up earlier on, which I sort of glossed over later, was that it also costs energy to make these things. And so you need to make sure that you are carbon negative between what you can, the energy you can save from having the producing your own electricity so that the coal plant does it, versus the electricity that would be required to produce that device in the first place. And it's not clear to me that accounting is obviously very complicated, but it's not clear to me on the outset that you would end up being ahead of the game. I hope you would be.
That was Simon Fraser University kinesiology expert inventor Max Donilon. He's figured out how to make a hybrid human that produces its own electricity just by walking. I see a lot of future for this technology outside the hospital applications, even though Professor Donilon doesn't. Frankly, his accounting of the true cost of fossil energy wasn't very good, as he uses figures provided by governments and corporations that doesn't count the Middle East wars, for example, as part of the cost of oil, much less the true cost to nature and future generations of burning all that carbon. His calculations of food costs are also based on oil-hungry industrial agriculture in the first world and meat eating. When the real costs are used, it is never more efficient to drive an SUV to the corner store than walk. Never. Still, inventions can go way beyond the conceptions of their creators, and the hybrid human generator idea may well be commonplace 50 years from now. I'm Alex Smith. That's my opinion.
I don't know how you came by this record, but you are now embarked upon a journey that must certainly lead you to change your life forever. If you were never a special person, you are a special person now. Hello, seeker. Now, don't feel alone here in the new age, because there's a seeker born every minute.
Thanks for joining me this week on Radio EcoShock. Don't forget you can download all our past shows plus tons of other green audio as free MP3 files at EcoShock.org. That's ECO shock like an electric shock .org. Nothing to sell, everything to tell. I'm Alex. Let's get together next week.